I believe last week we had indicated that we would like to take a few nights to give some thoughts out of Ephesians. Again, sort of continuing our survey of Paul's letters based upon observations that come out of being on the scene over there, being actually in the place that Paul ministered. Sometimes you get a little different feeling just from the very, I don't know, something about the atmosphere over there on a location that gives you some insight or some sense. And then, of course, you pick up the history a little more thoroughly. The letter to the Ephesians was directed toward people who were very sophisticated and not to Greek villagers as such. You may have gathered from watching Zorba the Greek, which was a movie made a century ago, a few years ago. You get the feeling from Zorba the Greek that by and large, Greeks all belong to little communities of whitewash buildings and fish and fishermen and so forth. In a sense, a lot of that is true. The Greek islands are pretty much the villager type, the simple community of herdsmen and fishermen and so forth. But Ephesus was quite a different story. The people of Ephesus were privileged to, I shouldn't say privileged, because that may not be a privilege, but basically it was their lot to be part of a very major metropolis, crossroads of the world in a sense over there, of a certain part of the world, commercial center. As I've pointed out to you before, actually Ephesus was a port city. Today the water is quite a few miles away from the city, but in the early days the water came right up to the city. It was silt that filled up the harbor gradually and made it impassable to the larger ships. Today we would have equipment to deal with that, but they didn't have that then. The harbor gradually filled up and the city moved further and further back from the water, and this was one of the reasons for its demise. But in the days that it was a port city, as I indicated to you some months ago, it was a magnificent city, built so much of marble, almost exclusively of marble, great marble streets, porticos and colonnades and so forth. It was a grand, glorious city. And this was the climate in which Paul ministered to people called the Ephesians. He went over there and made tents, not an occupation that would put him in the highest echelons of society in that city. He was not a smart lawyer or anything like that. He was just a simple tent maker, which at the gut level really comports more with the deepest sense of what life is all about. Not that there's anything wrong with having a career or to be in a profession, but the willingness of a man like Paul to spend his life as just a simple artisan, craftsman, making tents, and not to assume that he has to be the Lord Protector of the Ecclesia, or just simple maker of tents who taught. He had the qualifications to teach, it wasn't that, but he didn't elevate himself. And his general theme was, as he said to the Romans, not to think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think. He saw these grand metropolises of that day as facades more than anything else, and they were, because it didn't take long for the facade to crumble and the true vacuity of the society to be evident. The greatest cities of that part of the world, Rome and Ephesus, both came to grief in the process of history. Rome is an interesting city. It's a large metropolis. It certainly has only vague remnants of the grandeur that it formerly had. In many respects, could be disappointing. If you went to Rome expecting to find broad avenues and great plazas and so forth, as you are inclined to see in the movies, I never found very many of the grand plazas that were fabricated and filmed them over there. They give you the feeling that Rome is a grand and glorious city. Well, it's a big city, and it's like Los Angeles. Well, it's not even in the stature of Los Angeles. Los Angeles has been reconstructed to become, in its metropolitan area, quite a magnificent city. But in the old days of Los Angeles, it was just a city. It's more what Rome is like. Now, the reason I say that is because it has nothing of its grandeur of the days that Paul was there. But it has gone the way of all the flesh. And decadence is the keynote. I think that if you take the word decadence and write it across the face of civilization, you probably have the key word. We don't see it that way because we're too close to it. In other words, we see certain aspects of our greatness. We think in terms of human fame and fortune. One might look at some of the elite sections of our cities and think of the permanence of great wealth and so forth. But actually, it's all pretty much a facade. And Paul saw through that. The crucial thing for any individual on this earth, the crucial thing to understand is the decadence of the flesh, and to understand that it is a very ignoble shell or vessel in which resides the glory of the Spirit of God. You've got to understand that. You've got to recognize. If the Lord calls a person to a given profession, the things that might make one educated or to have the world's substance, if he calls one to that, there's no objection to that. What I'm saying today is not in any way to decry education. I spent a few years at it myself. What it is to keep perspective, to say that if you learn the lesson that this decaying flesh houses the glory of the Spirit of God, you will at once have got the heart of things and you will be able better to cope with your life. Remember the analogy I've used before of the bell curve, where you start out at the very beginning of your life with zero. Somebody carries you around. Then you give yourself to your career and to the development of your life and you throw everything into that. And in a very, very few short years, you're back down the other side and somebody's carrying you around again. You go into an old folks home, you may have spent all your energies accumulating properties and so forth, but all of that, that's all it takes is one stroke of the pen in the office of an attorney to change all of that. Your property now becomes under the caretaker relationship to somebody else. I've become the executor and the administrator and the conservator of persons and properties and other things, and I know that the stroke of the pen divests you if it appears that the person has become incapable of caring for their property and so forth. One stroke of the pen makes a conservator, and away you go off to the old folks home, and that's it. And all this frenzy and fuss and feathers to build that grand life, career, and so forth is all over as soon as it starts. I'm speaking very personally here. When you get to my age, you can reminisce a little bit and be excused for drifting around. I remember when I was in high school and we had the class prophecies. What are you going to do 20 years hence? And it looked like an impossible thing that you'd ever arrive at 20 more years down the line. It would be so far away that it was just a vague image in your mind. And there have been a couple of 20s go by since I was in high school. And it goes by so fast. Some of the older of you here can concur with me on that. I won't mention any names, but It goes by pretty fast, and it's all over. Now, if in that process you've learned this fundamental fact that we are spirits and not flesh, if you've learned that and that the flesh is merely the vessel, battered and scarred and whatever, but it's the vessel, and that the Spirit of Christ in us remains intact, and that Spirit of Christ is an extension of God, the great eternal Spirit. We've been writing some material on forgiveness, and I felt that before I could really write, I mentioned this Sunday, but I had to solve the problem of why should God feel we had to ask forgiveness for something since we didn't make the place in the first place. You know, it was his program. It's his baby. He made the world. We didn't ask for it to be made, and if we didn't come up to his standards, then I'm not sure we really are that much to be blamed. Of course, the great question, why did he make this mess in the first place, comes up. So I've been wrestling with that, and I think the most poignant or impressive answer to that is that God did not sit down on a day and decide to make something. On Saturday afternoon, God gets bored and says, hey, I think maybe I'll make something. Boom, boom, boom. Was not that way at all. His very nature, his spirit nature, could not help but express itself in creativity in a way he could hardly help but replicate himself as the eternal spirit. Life was pregnant within him, was vibrant within him. To live is to create for God. And so we were extensions of his spirit. I mean, he replicated himself, if you will. And here we are, spirits. Not miserable, measly little worms on the earth, but elements of the Spirit of God, clothed in the earthly vessel. As well might one be focused on the earthly vessel rather than the spirit within, as one might be focused on the box that contains the treasures. You girls have your box of jewelry. In our group, we're not worried too much about putting things in great safety vaults or anything else. A box on the dresser top will do for our little trinkets for the most part. Some people have some fairly valuable things, and they keep them in a chest of one kind or another. They're not worried if they get a little scratch on the chest, usually, but if something happens to the treasure or the jewelry inside the chest, that's something. I mean, if a burglar came into your home and you had some reasonable quantity of jewelry, now suppose he came into your home and he took the chest that you had with your pieces in it and dumped them all out on the dresser top and left with the chest. You wouldn't even bother to call the police, right? Wouldn't matter. But if he stole the jewels and left the chest, providing there was any value at all to them, then you'd call the police, right? Now, people make such a fuss over this vessel, the chest, and spend all their time burnishing the chest and doing all these things to embellish it and so forth. And it has nothing to do with the treasure inside. Better an old iron box, if it keeps the jewels safe, than some grandly tooled and embellished chest, if it doesn't keep the jewels safe. That's the way we look at it, right? Now, you must understand, if you understand that, you've got the heart of what it means to be in the world. It means that God has evolved us, he brought us about. The fact that the original pair stumbled makes not the slightest bit of difference to the availability to us today of this Spirit, especially since Christ came, you see. And people say, well, I had nothing to do with that sin in the beginning that Adam and Eve committed. I mean, if I'd been there, I certainly wouldn't have been taken in by that serpentine monster, because I don't even like snakes. I would have run, would have been the thought, you know. And so people do often make that point. I've heard it over and over again. Well, why should I be charged with something they did 6,000 years ago or more? Okay. Well, nobody's being charged with what they did. There's not a soul on earth that perishes because Adam and Eve committed that disobedience. All of that was taken care of in the cross or on the cross and the crucifixion of Christ. We all have today. Everyone brought into this world has the same choice Adam and Eve had. They chose to function apart from God. They thought that they were all right now to make choices that were out of keeping with what God wanted. And they made such a choice and faced the consequences of it. Every person today in this world who decides to function apart from God has made the same choice. Every person who has decided that it is essential to have the Spirit of God in us to function has made the choice in the other direction. We're free to make that choice. And we're not bound by something Adam and Eve did 6,000 years ago. Now, the consequences of their choice are that mortality was communicated to the race, not immorality. Adam and Eve did not transmit immorality to their offspring. They transmitted mortality to their offspring. Death was transmitted. That was the big problem. Death was transmitted to them. The decadence of the flesh, the inadequacy of the flesh was transmitted by them. So today, this decadence, this weakness in the flesh, does itself make it difficult for people to choose from an eternal perspective. So people tend to choose things that are also decadent in nature. When we have taken the Spirit of Christ into our spirits, we have resolved the problem forever for ourselves of that separation from God. Now, the death that is germane to the race is a reminder day in and day out of our dependence upon God. Adam and Eve forgot that. They made a choice based upon the belief that they could get along not following God's way or will. So they chose to function separately from it. We make the choice today, or we, as we live in this world, we are constantly reminded every day of our lives that we can't function without God. Every day brings its offenses, its weaknesses, its inadequacies. This is where forgiveness comes in. This is where penitence and remorse comes in, because possessed by the Spirit of Christ, we now are more keenly aware of the weakness of the flesh. So any choice that we make relative to the vessel, but relative to our earthly situation, any choice we make that in any way puts that earthly situation above the spiritual situation is a bad choice. It's as bad a choice as polishing up the chest and letting the jewels get stolen. A lot of things are allowable to us. A lot of things the things that we do on the earth do not throw us out of heaven necessarily, but they jeopardize the vitality of that spiritual oneness with Christ. So the glory of mankind, the glory of humanity, is the flow of the Spirit of God within us. That's the glory of each of us. The flesh without is very inglorious. Now, Paul makes this clear in a passage in 2 Corinthians 4, 6, and 7. God, who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, hath shined in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the presence of Jesus Christ. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power may be of God and not of us. So it is the energy of God, the creator of the universe, residing in us that furnishes the vitality of life to us, and all the stuff in the flesh is secondary. And if the focus be put on the flesh instead of the spirit, it is a bad choice, because it fails to recognize that all you can ever come to the conclusion about yourself is decadence. Death is all around us. Now that turns the tables on things. That makes God's creation of us not a whimsical, almost vicious thing, which you'd think of. In other words, it would say that whoever created this mess must have been a monster because of what monstrous things happen in the world. All those things have to do with the fleshly aspect of this world and not with the spirit. The evolving of spirits like unto himself is not a monstrous thing. The vessel in which the spirits must function has been made monstrous by the effects of evil in the world, which have come from Satan. But the continual testimony that God presents to Satan as well as to the world is, no matter how distorted the vessel may become and how battered, the spirit within remains the same. Eternal, vital, very like God in spirit. Now, how often the mind does not follow through? We understand that. The spirit wants to or recognizes the need, for example, of reaching out in love and understanding. The flesh doesn't follow through with that. The spirit says to be kind, thoughtful, mellow, all kinds of things. The flesh does not always follow through on that. But the fact that the spirit within us wants to do what is right, wants to flow properly with God and so forth, the fact that that spirit wants to do that is the proof of its presence. The very discouragement that you feel over your inadequacies is one of the surest evidences that the Spirit of God is within you. Distresses. All these things are evidence that the Spirit is in you, because that's the Spirit coming through. And the Spirit is our true nature, our true understanding of things. But as I said, the mind, for many different reasons, doesn't always put that together and function with it, you see. It doesn't always articulate it or express it. How many times have you felt within yourself that you shouldn't be acting the way you're acting? You know that you ought to act differently. You know that, you know, if you really had control of things, you'd do differently. Or you know after you've said something or after you've done something that you shouldn't have done that. And you don't know why you did it. Many, many times young people have said that to me. I don't know why I did that. I don't know why I acted that way toward my parents. But something, you know, we have the old common expression, the devil made me do it. You know, in the sense that people often do things they know they don't want to do. They wish they didn't feel that way. You wish you could be more charitable to someone or have not carried that grudge or not feel the way you do. That very attitude, rather than condemning you, affirms the presence of the Spirit in you, because if the Spirit were not in you, you wouldn't even think about it. You wouldn't care. That's the great transformation that takes place when the Spirit does come into us. A transformation not of always of our behavior patterns, but a transformation of our attitude toward our behavior patterns. Now, when this earthly nightmare is over, and we then are in the full expression of our spirit realities, when all this is over, then we'll look back on this as a bad dream. The mistakes you're making today, the misapplications, misappropriations, fallacies, faults, all these things that are happening to you today are but the evidence of the effects of decadence and the inadequacy of the flesh. All of the attitudes that you have toward those things are reflective of the Spirit of Christ within you. Now, if you can see it that way, it puts it all in perspective. So instead of putting yourself down and saying that you're no good or you're nobody, whatever, it may be true as far as the flesh is concerned. You may be what they call a psychoceramic. That's a crackpot. I received a license plate for my car with the initials FRK and then one and a one in front of it, one freak, you see. Well, I thought, all right, that's fair enough, you know. That's fair enough. This vessel is often freakish and out of sorts and inadequate. The vessels that we all possess. The thing that establishes a person's sanity is the recognition that they could possibly be insane. The moment you would say to your psychiatrist, if any of you have one, you know, I really think I'm insane. I think I ought to be put away. That would be the very moment he would feel, well, maybe you've made it after all. Maybe you're all right after all. You're not the person that says, I'm not insane. Who's crazy? I'm not crazy. The person that keeps protesting that they're not crazy might, in fact, be the very one that is crazy. So by the same token, the moment you have enough sense to understand the inadequacy of the flesh is the moment you probably are most in touch with reality. So it isn't to be accepting of our behavior patterns. I'm not suggesting that you continue acting as ornery as you have been. No, I'm not suggesting you continue to act carelessly or ornery. I'm just saying that correctly evaluating yourself, you need to recognize that you are a person of worth because of the spirit within you in spite of the inadequacies of the flesh. They are things that we come to expect. One of the things that produces mental instability or psychoses, especially, or neuroses, is the dropping of the defense mechanisms. For example, the person that has lost all ego defenses, such as the ability to rationalize or to sublimate or compensate and so forth, these are all escape mechanisms or defense mechanisms. The moment the person has lost the ability to defend, lost the defense mechanisms, that's when they're in the gravest danger. As long as you can continue to recognize in a practical way the inadequacies of the flesh and just deal with them more of the natural mind, as long as you can do that, you're going to be all right. Now, for example, the person who, because of this mistake or that mistake, loses the feeling of self-worth, you've blundered, you've made maybe some serious mistake, and you lose the feeling of self-worth, that's the danger point. As long as you can recognize that whatever mistakes you made, they are common to the human race. They're not wise, and that mistakes you make are not to be simply passed over, but the defense mechanisms come to your rescue. For example, in the, let's say in the school situation where a young person fails in a test. Now they could approach that problem by extreme depression to say, well, I'm just no good, I'll never make it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Go into a depression, perhaps drop out of school. The appropriate response to that is to analyze why one didn't make it. Rather than just say, I'm no good, you have to look for the reasons. You didn't study enough. Perhaps the professor was not clear. The teacher was not clear enough in their presentation. Perhaps you have to work on the memory or the reading or whatever it is. Or you may not have been feeling well that day. I see there are a lot of reasons why one fails in a given matter. Or if one is really realistic about themselves, they may say, well, that's a subject matter that I'm not particularly good in, but I'm good in something else. One may say, well, maybe I'm not college material, but I can be a good mechanic, or I can be a good tradesman of some kind. That's a compensation. I think one of the greatest things in the school system, if there are any great things there, might be the athletic program. because it gives opportunity for people that otherwise may not be too good in the academic to excel in something else. So the person says, well, I'm not very good at math, but I can maybe do well. I'm coordinated. I can do well on the football team or whatever. Well, somebody says, what if you're not good in either? Well, the wise or the stable person will stop to assess what they are capable of and more than something else and develop that rather than just backing away and saying, I'm no good. There's something they can do. Until a person has tried other options, there's no use to judge themselves on the basis of a single choice or situation. Now, that is the power. The reason I talk about it, that is the power of the defense mechanism. The student fails a test, figures out why, uses other things to judge the matter rather than just simply saying, I'm no good. All right, now, in looking at our human position, to have the capacity to honestly evaluate our situation and to say to ourselves, even though I've made all these mistakes in the flesh, yet still I am worthy in the spirit. To cling to that, you see, to go on in that, because the Spirit of God is not unworthy. The Spirit of God is not inadequate, and that's what possesses you. So that you hold to. The other you have to work on. You make mistakes, and you pay the price for them. There are penalties involved in our society in making mistakes. The penalty for miscalculating your change may be that you lose a dollar. The penalty for miscalculating business matters may be that you have to suffer some loss. You see, there are penalties for activity, and the person has to look at that and say, well, here are penalties that we pay for our carelessness, but that is not to say one is no good. The consequences of our actions we have to live with. The spirit is nevertheless a noble thing. The energy and power of our spirits is not dependent upon our being good, but upon the work of Christ within us, in spite of what we are or what we are not. One of the greatest tools of Satan, one of the most effective tools he has for throwing people into a tailspin, is discouragement. And discouragement comes from the failure to realize what I've been saying to you, that the Spirit is nevertheless a great thing, and there is need to make adjustments maybe in our lives. The vessel may be battered and cracked, but the contents remains the same. The Lord can help us deal with this outer vessel, but patch it up the best you can and get through life. And when it's all over, the spirit is the thing that's real. So guard the spirit. That is by, when I say guard the spirit, I mean by remembering that your choices ought to be made, whatever they are, in terms of the fact that the important part of us is the spirit and not the flesh. Well, I think we're going to have to stop there. Father, we ask you to take these words that we have shared tonight, use them for your glory and for the encouragement and strength of the believers. In Christ's name, amen.